Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Jones. Bowden.
He's got it.
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. It's a special day for us today because it's our 500th episode of the Analyst Inside Cricket. So, little celebration to us, and of course to all the people who've happily listened to us or unhappily listened to us over the last 4 years or so. Simon and I are very pleased to announce that. But we thought we'd mark our 500th episode by a proper sort of deep dive into England's fantastic one-day prowess. Now the holders of not only the 50-over World Cup, but the 20-over one as well. So it's a fantastic period for English one-day cricket over the last 5 or 6 years. And we have a special guest on today, a man who kind of kick-started that rejuvenation of the England one-day side in 2015, Paul Farbrace, who took over as the sort of caretaker coach through that early period in 2015-2016 before Trevor Bayliss arrived and was very much part of that whole setup as England headed towards the 2019 World Cup. So we'll hear from Farby in a bit. But Simon, of course, it's a slightly odd situation that England have now won the T20 World Cup as well as the 50-over World Cup 4 days after the final, that wonderful final in Australia. They're playing Australia again in 50-over cricket. So, and they lost as well, quite heavily. But it doesn't put a blot on what they've achieved, does it?
Absolutely not. It's a mark in the sand, isn't it? It's a flag in the sand. You'll never take that away from the players. In 2022, in Australia, they won the T20 World Cup. We remember Australia for winning their World Cups, don't we? And those are massive moments. You can never take them away. But it does seem a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? 4 days later, they're back in action again. Okay, only three players who played in the final play today in Adelaide. But I don't know. It must be quite hard to sort of get yourself up for it. It's not even part of the ICC World Cup Super League, this tournament. It is sort of fixture fulfilment, isn't it? And, you know, you've scratched our back. You came over during COVID. We need to go over and fixture fulfil with you. TV rights. Or the crowd wasn't particularly big in Adelaide. Sometimes you do wonder about the amount of international cricket that's being played, and this sort of highlights it. I see that New Zealand and India are just about to start a T20 series as well. The cricket world just goes on and on and on. It's spinning round and round and round, and at some point it might just spin out of control. But no one can take away from England what they did in Sunday in Adelaide and in Melbourne and last Thursday in Adelaide as well against India. That incredible win.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't quite as incredible as the 2019 World Cup final, which I'm sure many of you now know there is a documentary about, which we've put together.
Is
the Greatest Game. Ah, yes. And we are going to play a couple of more clips from that film at some stage in this conversation, which we're going to have with Paul Farbrace, who for the last three or four years as actually being director of cricket at Warwickshire. But his really kind of integral part of England's rejuvenation as a one-day side, I think, has been unheralded in many ways, because the leading lights of Owen Morgan and Trevor Bayliss and Andrew Strauss's influence as well have almost sort of taken over the headlines. But Farby, you had a really big influence. I mean, you were part of the coaching setup in 2015 at that World Cup, which was obviously a dismal failure, and then largely took over until Trevor Bayliss arrived. So just go back to 2015, can you, and sort of recall what the mood was like when you kind of, in a way, inherited the team from the 2015 World Cup, with Strauss now as director of cricket. What was the change that really you felt had the most transformative effect at that point?
Well, I think, I mean, the first thing I would say is, and I learned a lot from Trevor Bayliss in on this, that it is about the players. It's not about Trevor or Straussie. It is about Morgs. And I've said many times that Morgs is the single biggest factor in England winning that World Cup in 2019. And I was delighted to see him on the outfield on Sunday at the end of the T20 World Cup, taking part in some of the interviews. And because he has played such an integral part. He has been, without a shadow of a doubt, the most important person. But it's about the players. It's not about the coaches and administrators. We're lucky. And as Trev used to say, we're lucky enough to throw a few cones out in the morning, hit a few balls and sit back and watch the lads go and play the game. And I learned that from him very early on. But when I look back at that time, and I've said this many times, Peter Moores was actually very, very unlucky. Our first real change was immediately after that dismal World Cup. And it was dismal. We only beat Scotland and Afghanistan in our group games. And we played a very poor form of the game in that tournament in Australia and New Zealand. We were absolutely destroyed by Australia in the first game, hammered by New Zealand in the second game, and we never recovered. We really never recovered. And obviously we crashed out to Bangladesh. But Peter Moores, the game, the one-day game that turned out to be his last game, we made, I think we had seven people making their debut in that game in Ireland, in Dublin. Owen Morgan didn't come back from the IPL. We went with a very young, inexperienced team. Lewis Gregory, Sam Billings were the two that were left out. Mark Wood played his first game. You know, we had a very different looking England team. And the game only lasted a couple of hours and rain affected it. And then from that moment on, Strauss came in immediately after that. Morsey left his role as the head coach. And we went into a New Zealand series in England, starting at Edgbaston in 2015, that I looked after. Morgs was captain. We had this first team meeting, which was a bizarre meeting in the viewing area at Edgbaston. And Strauss introduced it and then sat back. Morgs then started to talk and stopped and looked at Straussie and said, "Mate, do you mind?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, sorry. And he got up and he left. And he left us to the meeting. And it was all these young lads were looking at Strauss as if to say, "Blimey, it's Andrew Strauss." And you know, he there he was sat in our team meeting. So once he went, and the meeting lasted no more than 15, 20 minutes. And the great thing about it was that Morgs just kept talking about play how you want to play, play how you've played for your county. Don't change the way you're playing because of you're playing for England. And that first game, we got 407 or what it was, 400 runs in a 50-over game for the first time ever, against a team that only a couple of months before had absolutely slaughtered us in Wellington. They almost beat us before the lunch break. The game was almost over in that one session. And but for Chris Wokes bowling Brendan McCullum with a waist-high full toss that just trimmed the bails, I mean, he'd hit Stephen Finn to just about every part of Wellington you can think of. There was one of those, I don't know what car it was, on a stand. I mean, how it wasn't destroyed, I don't know. Because just it was inside the ground. It's part of the sponsors. And I think McCullum was trying to break every window and dent every panel in it. And most of them came off poor old Finney. It was horrible. I mean, it was probably the most horrible defeat I've ever been part of. And as I say, to then, a couple of months later, play that same team, Finney got McCullum out. He dragged one on to his stumps for seven or eight. And we defended 400 comfortably and won a brilliant game. And it was a it was an extraordinary series. Jason Roy out first ball in that game. But we stayed with him because he played the right way. And Morgs went and played the way that he asked his team to play. And that's why he was the single most significant person, because if he'd have talked about playing a certain way and then not played that way himself, others would have gone into their shells and played for themselves and been cautious and just try to keep themselves in the team. But he in the last game, all square, 2-2 in the series at Riverside at Durham, he got out first ball, caught deep mid-wicket off Mitchell Santner. And now it was because he thought that was the right shot to play first ball. And it allowed others to play that way. We end up winning the series 3-2. But it was a remarkable series. And as I say, Morgs's way of playing and way of leading was just absolutely outstanding.
But also, it was important, wasn't it, to get the right players. Yes, OK, you've got the right captain, but you need the right players to sort of implement whatever his designs, desires are. And it was about, you know, player identification as well. So how did you know what players to pick?
Well, interestingly, we played at the start of that summer, May time, we played New Zealand in two test matches. And we played the first test match at Lord's. And it was the game that Ben Stokes came back into the test side. I put Stokes at six because I felt that the more responsibility you gave him, the more you get out of him.
So he was down the order a bit lower before, wasn't he?
He'd been batting at eight at various times before that. And to be fair, again to Morsy, Stokesy had a period of about 10 innings where he didn't get above 10, you know, and he really was struggling. So I put him.
But he wasn't even in that World Cup squad, was he? He came to Sri Lanka. I remember because he came to Sri Lanka in 2014 when Alistair Cook was still captain, and he had such a bad series, bat and ball, that he didn't make the World Cup squad. Of course.
Well, effectively, you know, that and that's, you know, we could go back over that as well. But I mean, Morgs effectively captained Cookie's team to that World Cup. You know, and we were seventh going into that World Cup, and you know, history tells you if you're not in the top three in the world going into a World Cup tournament, and that was a significant factor for England in that 2019 World Cup. If you're not in the top three, you've got very little chance of winning that World Cup. It's a bit different than the T20, but in the 50 overs, you've got very little chance of winning it. So we went into that tournament number seven in the world. But, you know, Stokes, obviously, as I say, we moved him up to six. We played those two test matches. We won an unbelievable game at Lord's. Unbelievable. Bank holiday Monday, full house, people filling into the ground. It was a brilliant, brilliant test match. The next day, we actually had our selection at Lord's for the 50-over team to play New Zealand in the five games. And I remember standing outside the Grace Gates. I got out of the taxi. I stood outside the Grace Gates for 45 minutes on the phone to Trevor Bayliss, who had been announced on the last day of that test match. And I spent 45 minutes stood next to an Australian TV crew who were outside the Grace Gates, hoping to chat to somebody of importance. And I literally was 5 yards from them chatting to Trev about what we should do in terms of team. And he was adamant. He'd seen this bloke called Jason Roy, who played some cricket out in Australia. And he said he liked the way he had a bit of swagger about him, and he was a good fielder. And he said he looks like he's a sort of bloke, mate, we could do within our team. So he was a name I went into the meeting with. He wanted a spinner who could spin it both ways. So Adil Rashid was the obvious choice. And he wanted characters. He wanted people who had something about them in the team. And so I remember that meeting. Morgs, myself, Strauss, there was Mick Newell, Angus Fraser, Jimmy Whittaker. We all sat in that meeting room. And we picked the group that played in that series against New Zealand. As I say, Jason Roy was picked. He opened the bat and he got a first baller in that first game. He hardly got any runs in that New Zealand series, but we kept him in for the Australian series later that summer because of the way that he played, because of the character, because of that bit of strut, that bit of arrogance about him that he possessed. And he got 200s in that final series against Australia. We lost that series 3-2. So we played the two teams that had hammered us in the World Cup, that had been the winners and runners-up of that World Cup. And we played them within a couple of months. And we won one series 3-2. We lost the other series 3-2. And that series, we were 2-0 down, came back to 2-2, lost the final game against Australia at Manchester. So the whole summer was about test your boundaries. what can we achieve as a team? There were no game plans. We had no game plan. It was just go out and play how you want to play. Attack the ball, play your shots. When we bowl, we just look to take wickets. Rash, we just kept saying to Rash, if you take 4 for 80 every game in the middle when you bowl, they'll have less wickets left for the last 10 overs. So the more wickets you take in the middle, brilliant. Don't matter how many runs you go for. 4 for 80, we'd take every time. Plunk it, run in and bowl fast. Just bounce them. Get wickets. If they've only got 3 wickets left at the end, happy days. David Willey, run in and swing the new ball. You get a couple of wickets. Brilliant. Fantastic. And that's how we played. And we kept talking about this thing about having no game plan. And one of the things that Trevor and I used to chuckle about was that we'd watch TV or we'd read the newspapers or whatever. We'd be in the car listening to the radio and a player would come on and talk about, you know, there's no game plan. Or they do an interview in a newspaper and they say, there's no game plan. We're just playing with freedom. Well, it was brilliant because they were then repeating what we were getting across to them. And they really were playing with this unbelievable freedom. We then started to develop a game plan. And our game plan was on two sides of A4 paper. It was really, really simple. It was about attacking the ball at all opportunities, whether that was with the bat, whether that was with the ball as bowlers or in the field. And we just decided that we would keep picking people who had the character to play for the team and not get caught up in playing for themselves and not surviving or just doing enough to get picked in the next game. It was all about what the personality, the character of that person to play for the team at all times. And Morgs only wanted people who would play for the team. And as I say, he led that. And he kept doing it. I remember the Champions Trophy game. We go on to 2017, the Champions Trophy game against Australia. We had to win the game at Edgbaston. We were 9 for 3. He ran down the wicket first ball and smeared it through extra cover. And the whole dressing room just relaxed and said, okay, that's how we play. We knocked them off. We chased without losing another wicket. Morgan and Stokes got hundreds. And in many ways, as I say, that's why Owen was so, so important to the team. For a captain to live the way he talks is not an easy thing to do. It sounds easy, but it's really not an easy thing to do. But he did it brilliantly.
You really helped him, clearly, by the way you coached, the way you managed behind the scenes. And I'm just going to play a little clip, actually, from our documentary, The Greatest Game, with two players, Mark Wood and Jason Roy, just talking about the things that Trevor said to them that really helped them or helped the team get the best out of those two players. So you'll hear from Mark Wood, you'll hear from Strauss and Bayliss, and also from Jason Roy.
Trevor Bayliss, typical Aussie, sort of salt of the earth. I remember when I wasn't performing so well, I said, what do you want me to go away and work on? He said to me, I want you to have a bit more mongrel. I was like, mongrel? Like a dog with a bone, like never let go of it. You want it. You want it bad. And you'll do anything to get it.
Trevor loved the rough diamond. He loved the guy that was from the wrong side of the tracks. A player that didn't nod his head obediently when people told him to do things. It had a bit of sort of spirit about him.
Well, I remember having some custom-made shoes done, and I had Roy Boy on them, and oh, that wound him up a treat.
I don't want players getting too big for their boots. No pun intended.
Roy, one of those. I was like, what? And I was still quite young at the time. I was like, oh no, this shit is all over me here.
So I went back into the change room and stuck some plaster on the back of my shoes.
And he had taped on, written in Sharpie, Bayliss.
I don't think we saw those shoes again for the next 4 years.
It's a lovely story, and I think it captures the importance of managing egos, doesn't it, in a team? Because, you know, you've got, in an England team especially, you've got all these big characters and strong personalities who can get carried away with their own importance and dominate too much, and that can cause issues in a team. So how do you manage that? It's little kind of tricks, I suppose, that Trevor had there. But also there'll be other mechanisms as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, Jason Roy is a great example. And I've used Jason so many times over the last couple of years. That first series when he got picked, Trevor Bayliss has seen something about him playing in Sydney that he liked about him. He didn't know him. He'd never met him, but he just liked his swagger. He liked his confidence. He thought he was really good in the field, and he thought he was the sort of bloke that we could do within our team, you know. And so when Jason played in that first series, it was really important that he kept playing that way. When we came to that second series against Australia and he got his 200s, and Trev started to get into him a little bit as he got to know him, I kept reminding Jace that he was in the team because there was something that Trev liked about him. And he liked that bit of swagger and that bit of bravado about him. So Jace always knew that Trev was his fan. That's how he got in the team. So things like the shoes was a great one. I'll give you another brilliant example. We were playing in Cape Town, and we were playing a T20 game in Cape Town against South Africa. And Jace had had a stinker in the field. He'd had a horror in the field. And he was sitting next to me and Trev watching the game, and he must have been out, and we were sitting next to us, and there was a bit of fielding. And I said to Trev, "God, that was magnificent. Look at that, brilliant athleticism." And he said, yeah, shame some of our lads weren't on it like that tonight. And Jace, you can see Jace starting to think, oh, this is me they're coming for here. And I said, to be fair though, mate, I said, it's not easy, is it, when you got that belly in the way? It's not always easy to reach down and get the ball, is it? And he was like, what do you mean like that? Of course, Jason sparked up. And Jason and Trevor and I just set him up nicely. But because of the relationship we had with him, we could have those sorts of conversations. We didn't need to say, you know, take the one side and say, mate, your fielding weren't very good tonight, in all serious. We could have a conversation with him, taking the mick a little bit, having a bit of lightheartedness. And he knew exactly what we meant. He knew exactly where we're at. And Trevor and I could do that. We did that with another player. I'd never forget. Player getting a run out in a test match and saying to me, oh, what did Trev say? And I said, oh, blimey, the traffic cone has grown legs. And the player said, really? I said, yeah. I said, Trev's never thought you were any good at fielding. Anyway, he went straight up to Trev and he said, is that true? And he said, yeah, mate. He said, I've never seen a traffic cone move so quickly. And it was the fun that we could have with players, because if you've got a relationship with players whereby you can have that sort of relationship and you can get your message across with a bit of humour and a bit of fun, they know what you mean. But they knew that, you know, we meant it, but we didn't have to do it in a heavy-handed way. We didn't have to shout. Trev never raised his voice. Stokes used to come back to Trev a lot in team meetings. So we'd finish a game. We had one at Old Trafford. We finished a game and Trev was doing a bit of review. And Stokes, he just said, actually, Trev, I disagree. I disagree with you. I think, actually, we did try and do it the right way. We just didn't execute our shots very well. And Trev said, ah, great, mate, carry on. And he was like, well, this is what I think. And then someone else joined in. And the same happened in New Zealand. We lost a game down in Dunedin. And Trev thought that we'd been a bit reckless with our shots. And Joss and Stokesy joined in and said, no, I disagree, Trev. I think it was the right way to go. And then I joined in with them. And the three of us were almost challenging Trev in front of the team. And his man management was so good. The next day, we got off the bus in Christchurch to walk into the hotel. And he said, oh, mate, let me buy you a sandwich. And we went into the little cafe bar at the hotel. And he bought me a sandwich. And he said, I've had a chat with Stokesy and Joss. And I told them that yesterday it was fantastic. I love the way they challenged me in front of the team. Absolutely brilliant. I want that. I want them. He said, I don't know all the answers. I don't know everything. He said, I want them to challenge. And I want others to know it's safe. And what he was saying to me was, mate, it was good of you to join in yesterday and challenge me. So he made me feel better without saying to me, oh, well done, mate. I was happy with you doing that yesterday. Because I was thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I shouldn't have done it in front of the others. But I knew that I was on safe ground because I know Trev well enough. But his management of the way that he did it and the way that he wasn't precious. You know, he used to say to me, mate, me and you have never played Test cricket. We've got no idea about Test cricket, international cricket. But we need players who have in our coaching team. And he was always happy to have players with Sri Lanka and with England that had played international cricket in our coaching setup, because he felt that was really important. So, you know, a lot of coaches would shy away from that because they wouldn't want to be sort of upstaged by someone who'd done better than them in the game or had a bigger name. He never cared about that. He had no ego. He's got no ego. And that's why players, like that story Woody's telling, they could have that conversation with Trev because they knew that he was just a normal bloke and there was no ego and there's no side to him.
So was it fun? I mean, it sounds to me as though it might have been sounding like quite fun to play in that team in that period. Or was it, you know, were the pressures of international cricket still there and still sort of hard on the players?
Yeah, I think, Simon, you're always going to have that bit of pressure when you play international cricket. But Trev used to, you know, when I first started working with him, I asked him what it is that he saw in me as a coach. And he said, mate, there's two things you got that I haven't. And he said, you're well organised and you like talking. And you know, there was no like, you know, you bring in a great tactical knowledge or technical knowledge. It was, he just wanted people around him who had things that he didn't have. And he loved having Collie around because Collie was all energy and action and there was always something going on with Collie around the place. He loved Thorpey about the place because he thought Thorpey was a coach of how to score runs. He wasn't a coach of technique. He was and Thorpey had great stories, a great sense of humour, and Trev loved having him around the team. So it was fun. And Trev used to say, you know, listen, it's pressurised enough as it is. It's about enjoying it. And our job is to take the pressure off the players and not put pressure on the players. And you know, the test match against Australia, we got beaten by 400 runs at Lord's in 2015. And he came in at the end and he just said, well, lads, that's not what we wanted. That's not what we planned for. But at the end of the day, he said, tomorrow morning, we'll wake up, the sun will be shining and we'll still be breathing. And after that, every time we had a tough day, Stokes would come in the changing room and he'd say, Trev, still be breathing in the morning, mate. And it was that sort of, he had this knack of being able to take pressure off and relax people. And he, you know, he wasn't a laugh and joker, but he loved the stories. He loved the fun. He loved us playing football in the mornings. And that came from the players. You know, the players, Stokes, he said to me one day, oh, he played football somewhere. And I said, well, if we had a football, we'd play. Next day, three footballs turned up and we used to play football. And it wasn't for any other reason than it created something that we could talk about during the day, you know, whether it was, you know, someone falling over or someone scoring a goal or whatever it might be. It created a bit of fun and a bit of banter. And Trev liked to have people in the dressing room who relaxed, told stories, had a bit of fun. He enjoyed that. And he was really good at allowing people to just to be themselves and try and take the pressure off them as much as he could.
One thing you said towards the start was that, you know, you explained why you picked the players, why Trevor liked Jason Roy. He wanted someone that could spin it both ways, so he picked Adil Rashid. When you started picking those players, how quickly did you think you could be really successful, or was it just felt too experimental at the time? You thought, oh, this could go horribly wrong. Or did you have that sense? Yeah, we're really onto something here. I suppose at what point did you think that?
I think quite quickly into that group of coming together, because look, we had some unbelievable players, you know, Butler, Root, Stokes, Morgan, you know.
Hales was there then, wasn't he? Alex Hales.
Yeah, Hales, Roy, Bairstow came into it. I mean, I think that the real turning point for me was 2017, the Champions Trophy. And we talked about how important that tournament was because it was almost a dress rehearsal for the World Cup. And we chatted to a lot of people who'd been involved in World Cup. Eddie Jones, we talked about the Australian World Cup when he was the coach that England won the rugby. We talked to Stuart Lancaster when he was coach of England at the World Cup that didn't go particularly well. We talked to lots of people. And the thing that we decided was that Champions Trophy was going to be a big thing. If you remember, we had a really poor semi-final in Cardiff against Pakistan, and we went back to playing an old-fashioned way of playing. People were coming off saying, it's a 180 pitch, it's a 180 pitch. So we started to try and edge our way to 180, and Pakistan knocked off, won the game. At the end of the game, we spent an hour in the changing room not discussing that game. We spent an hour talking about if we were going to be serious about winning the World Cup in 2019, we had to cope with the pressure of being the favourite. We had to cope with the pressure of coming into that tournament. We decided through the meetings that we'd had, Strauss, Morgs, myself and Trev, we decided that we wanted to be number one in the world about 15 to 18 months leading into that World Cup in 2019. And we did. We went in 18 months out. We were number one in the world leading into that World Cup in 2019. But that night in Cardiff was massive, because we talked about, if we're really serious about winning the World Cup in 2019, we're going to be the home team under pressure going into that World Cup. And we're not going to just talk about we want to compete. We're going to talk about we want to win it, and we're expecting to win that World Cup. And that night was a really, really important hour that we spent in that changing room. And Morgs talked about making sure that when we got into series, where it was going to come down to the last game, and we treated it as a knockout game, because we weren't going to get many games where we could treat them as knockout games. And that knockout game that we lost to Pakistan, I think, was an absolute pivotal moment in them winning the World Cup in 2019. Because if you remember, they lost to Sri Lanka at Headingley and needed to win the last two group games to get through to the semi-final, which meant they effectively had four knockout games to go and won all four to win that World Cup. You know, lost to Australia at Lords in a pretty tough game, lost against Sri Lanka at Headingley. And a bit like this last World Cup, as soon as that team got to a point where it was absolute do or die cricket and there was only one way to go, I think in this last, you know, T20 World Cup, they batted the best from the moment it became do or die. And exactly the same happened in that 2019 World Cup. But I think that 2017 Champions Trophy semi-final, the hour in the dressing room at Cardiff after that defeat, was an absolute pivotal moment for that team.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
One of the most important characters in this whole England rejuvenation in one-day cricket has been Adil Rashid. And Paul Farbrace identified him earlier as someone that they picked on because he was a wrist spinner, because he could spin the ball both ways. I think one of the interesting things that we found out from interviewing him for this film was the impact that Islam has had on his life. And just to kind of give you a bit of context, he came into the England side actually initially when he was really young, sort of 18, 19, and had a slightly erratic experience. Not surprising, really, considering A, his youth, and secondly, leg spin, so difficult to command and master, a very fickle art. And it's no good if you're tense. And one of the interesting things about his interview in our film is that he explains how he was able to relax in his art of spin because of his faith in Islam. So just listen to this bit.
You don't get time to get ready. You've got to go 4, 5, 6 balls at a time.
So my dad loved his cricket. Whatever he knew, he passed it on to me. He sacrificed everything. We have a game at 9 o'clock, you know, we'll have to set off at 7. And he would be doing taxis at night. So he'd be finishing taxis maybe 4 or 5 in the morning, so maybe he'd have an hour's sleep. You know, take me to cricket, stay with me all day, and then and repeat that whole circle. I first broke through in 2009. I was 18. It's like a dream come true in terms of cricket. You have a bad game. Until the next time you perform well, you're really constantly thinking about it. You're really down. My belief of Islam, it was something at that time where I felt as though I needed. Because as a Muslim, this was my belief, but I wasn't really practicing it. that was probably the turning point of my life, I would say. My mindset now is completely different. You know, the purpose in life is pleasing God and making sure I'm a good Muslim, a good person. Cricket is something you give your 100% for, but it's not anything beyond that. As a result, cricket took care of itself.
So I think in a way, the success of the final, winning the final in 2019, was almost as much as a triumph for the players. It was a great tribute to the contributions of so many fathers and coaches and mentors of the players who dedicated their lives to helping their sons develop. And also to this richness of backgrounds that the players had. Rashid being an example of someone who's a devout Muslim, and who I think his faith enabled him to relax in his game, and that enabled his skill to flourish.
100%. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the diversity in that team is something that is that should not be missed and should be really celebrated, because it is a really diverse team. And in terms of so many areas. And I think, again, the environment that we were all able to create, and not just us as coaches, but captain, senior players, medical staff, people around the group, there was a lot of diversity within that group. There really was. There was a huge amount of diversity. And the great thing was that it was a very safe environment for people to be in. And it, because it was all about, can you raise the bar? Can you make mistakes? Are you prepared to make mistakes to get better? Because it's really easy to talk about being the best version of yourself that you can be. And we all, in sport, we all talk a lot about challenging people, being the best version. It takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of character to be the best. Because when you're in international cricket, if the environment is about surviving, then you actually just do enough to stay in the team. You score enough runs. You just take it up. You just do enough. And you over practice, and you do things that you think that the coaches want you to do and say. This team has never been about that. This team has always been about how far can we push the limits? How good can we be? And the only way we're going to do that is to make mistakes in practice, make mistakes in games, attack the ball one-handed. Adil Rashid is England's most improved fielder from the time he started to where he is now. And I used to say, and people laughed at me, by playing football in the mornings improved Rash's fielding, because Rash wasn't a very good footballer when we started. But by playing football and learning to be more balanced, more coordinated, receive the ball from the side, receive the ball from the left, pass it forward, turn around, whatever, he improved his balance and coordination. And then it started to come into his fielding. We all used to say to Rash, and I promise you, we used to say to Rash, attack every single ball. Because it was easy to hide him at 45 on the one. And he got a run out. He ran Chris Gayle out, direct hit at Bristol off his own bowling, and ran Chris out when he was going brilliantly and changed the format of the game. And we all we ever said to Rash was, you attack every single ball. If you attack it and you stop a run or you stop the second, fantastic. If you make a mistake, that's down to me, because I'm encouraging you to pick it up one-handed. Rash is the most improved fielder in the England team. Now, that only came about by feeling safe and valued and wanted and respected for who he was and for what he was, and not trying to be something that he wasn't, or not trying to fit into an environment that he didn't actually feel he fitted into. And I think the environment that was created allowed a lot of those players with their very diverse backgrounds to fit in and feel part of it. And it was brilliant at the end of games and the end of series in particular to see all the families in and around the dressing rooms when the team won or lost. But the families were all in, all part of it. And it was a real diverse group of people. But that safety and that real feeling that you belonged was a really important thing. And the players, senior players, did that brilliantly. You've only got to look at, you know, Sunday in Melbourne. You know, you look at Owen Morgan, as I say, was there on the touchline. But Butler, Moeen Ali, Adil Rashid, you know, that they Ben Stokes, you can see the friendship. You can see there is a real love for one another and a real enjoyment of one another's success. And that isn't, that's not been made up through lots of, you know, team building exercises or, you know, getting someone in to talk about how you should behave as a team. That's by having quality people together who have a shared passion and a shared love, but look out for one another. And that was something that developed and built over a long period of time.
One thing we've talked quite a lot about is the, you know, the excitement of playing and almost, you know, you talked about no plan. So that in a sense, that was a plan and a change of approach from England. I listed sort of World Cups going back to 1992, and there's a long list of failure there. Where did all these players come from? I mean, you've been in the game a long time, Paul. Why is it just about approach? Or for some reason, do England have a, you know, to use that phrase, a golden generation? And how has that happened, if they have?
To be honest, I think that those players, Morgan, Butler, Root, Stokes, by playing the way that they played and having success and really going back to their counties and telling their counties how much fun it was playing for England in that time and how much fun it is now playing for England. And what they've done is that players learn from players. They don't learn from coaches. Coaches, we facilitate the learning. And I think those players have gone back and they've almost sort of, through playing that way and realise it's safe to do that, they've created this knock-on effect.
And they've unleashed something, really.
Absolutely, they have. I think they have. I think these players have shown other players in county cricket that it's safe to play this way. It's safe to hit your first ball for six. If it's there to hit it for six, it's safe to reverse sweep. And if you get out, the coach is not going to tell you off. I know coaches that have told people off for playing reverse sweeps, but we didn't. We encouraged it. At the moment, England could pick two teams to compete in any world tournament with white ball cricket and probably a third. And we saw that with the Pakistan series two summers ago. Because of COVID, we had to suddenly pick this team. We hammered Pakistan 3-0 here in England. And a very good Pakistan team with a second stroke third 11 being put out by England. And that's not being arrogant and saying we're going to dominate world cricket for the next 20 years. But what we have got is a real influx of people who have seen that it's not about slogging, but it's actually about having the freedom to play how you want to play. And it's a really easy thing to say. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. So I think the players have almost shown the others playing county cricket that it's okay to do that. And what's happened is that coaches have actually accepted that it's okay to do that as well and have allowed players to play that way.
So do you think the rest of the world's going to catch on as well? We have a sort of almost like player arms race where everyone's going to go for it and play with freedom. And how does that translate to the rest of the world? Because the world's going to look at England, aren't they? And they say, well, okay, they're double world champions. Perhaps they are onto something. Perhaps we need to copy them.
Well, I mean, the great, in the last week, the best thing that I've heard is Rahul Dravid saying we need to let our players go and play in these tournaments around the world. I mean, you know, everybody's looked at the IPL and said, this is a tournament I want to play and this is the most important tournament. Actually, you know, the 100 is a fantastic tournament. I know it gets a bit of stick, but the 100 is a brilliant tournament because if I was an England selector, I'd be watching the 100 saying, I want to see the next group of England players, batting, bowling, fielding, keeping wicket, coming through the 100 in front of a full house, live on television and, you know, being broadcast on radio. Every game is on television and radio. It's live. Everybody's watching it, listening to it. You've got people watching the game that never watched it before, but the crowds are full. Now you're seeing whether people can cope with that added pressure. One of Trevor Bayliss's great things he used to do, when a player was getting close to selection, he'd start mentioning their name to the media so their name got out. And then he'd watch their scores to see if they carried on scoring runs or they dried up, because it was a one way of him finding out whether they would cope with the pressure of international cricket. Now we're seeing that with 100 because we're seeing full grounds, as I say, you know, live television, live radio, whatever. And we can see whether people can cope with it. Are they the people that want to be 30 not out? Or do they want to be the bloke who gets a quick 15 and gets out and leaves it to their mates to finish the game? That's what Trevor used to talk about, smart cricket. Have you got the guts? Have you got the desire to be there at the end and see it home? And one of the things that we added to our game plan in the last 2 years was our number 5, 6 and 7. Are they capable of getting a not out to win the game? Or are they actually going to leave it to their mates to win the game? And that was something that he was really, really big on. So I think the rest of the world will look at this and say, how can we do it? It's one thing saying you want to do it. It's not easy doing it. it takes a lot of courage to actually go out and play that way and play with that freedom. Playing with freedom and being positive and aggressive sounds easy. It's not at all. It takes a lot for a player to do that.
So if you were Rahul Dravid now, say you were taking over as coach of India and their mission is to win the World Cup next year in India at home, taking apart, you know, the individual players, what culture do they need to create and how do you do it?
Can I just nip in there, just a corollary from that question? Does it make a difference, though, because the World Cup is in India and India know their conditions so well? So one of the interesting things about India playing in Australia is, you know, they nearly lost to Pakistan. Most days they would have lost that game, wouldn't they? They'd probably lost it 8 times out of 10 and they got absolutely taken down by England. So is it actually that they're very safe in India? So that actually they probably need to continue in the way they normally play. They know the conditions really well, but it might be for winning overseas might be the issue for them, the tournaments overseas. I just throw that question in there.
I would go back to this T20 T20 World Cup. England lost to Ireland, and England didn't. They bowled with real freedom and pace, and Ireland played really well. They bowled a bit short first 6 overs, and it gave Ireland a bit of room to swing their hands, right? But England batted with caution. England played old-fashioned white ball cricket in that run chase. And it wasn't until Moeen Ali came in and started to chance his arm and actually took the game on that England looked like winning the game. And then Duckworth Lewis finished the game and Ireland deserved to win because they played the best cricket. Once England got to a point where it was do or die, they played very positive attacking cricket. And the semi-final against India, everyone talked about the fact that the ball didn't swing for the Indians. But India, as soon as Jos Buttler went down the wicket, first ball to Bhuvanesh Kumar, he dragged his length back. And everyone talked about India being cautious with the bat. I thought they were too cautious with the ball because Bhuvaneshwar has a magic hold over Buttler and he gets him out a lot where he pitches the ball up and nicks him off. And Jos knows that. So he went down the wicket first ball. As soon as he went down the wicket, Bhuvie then started to bowl back of a length, which meant the ball wasn't going to swing. He bowls 78 miles an hour. And if he's not swinging, he's cannon fodder. And Jos, by being really positive and aggressive, he might have nicked the first ball going down the wicket and India all over England. It's a different run chase. But I actually think that the way that Hales and Buttler played against a fantastic Indian seam attack made them shorten their length and made it easier for England to score square of the wicket on a shorter square of the wicket boundary.
So in a way, what you're saying almost that it's the fearlessness of the England side is one thing, but you've got to apply that fearlessness to the situation and be smart and, you know, overcome whatever the opponent may have as a threat. So if you translate that into what India might do in their own World Cup, in their own home conditions, I suppose they just have to think a bit more laterally about how to impose themselves on the opposition.
Yeah, definitely. But also, you know, let's be honest, England going to India to play in the World 50 over World Cup, there's a lot of small grounds in India. There's a lot of very good pitches and the new ball might swing a little bit and all right, it might grip later on. But this England team are so fearless that they will just take the game on. When England don't play at their best, and the same with other teams, when it becomes a normal game, is when England try and be cautious and try and overthink the situation. As soon as they actually don't be cautious and actually just take the game on for what it is and play to their strengths, that's when they play their best cricket. And I think the team that will win in India will be the team that doesn't get too wrapped up in what the conditions might be like, but actually who's got the most positive approach, who has got the boldest approach. And I think if I was in the Indian team now, I'd be saying flat pitches, small boundaries, we can go and get big runs here. And it doesn't matter. You know, England's bowling in the T20 World Cup, it isn't a fantastic bowling attack, but their batting is so good that they can win games from anywhere. So, you know, the Pakistan final, Pakistan had the best bowling attack in that World Cup. But England played brilliantly to start with, lost a couple of wickets, went a bit cautious, and then Stokes played that brilliant innings to get them home. But then Moeen Ali came in and started playing shots. All of a sudden, the game went from being a bit tight to England win at a canter. And I think that mental approach that England have is created by that fantastic no fear in the dressing room. Matthew Mott, the best thing that Motti's done is to let the team get on and play. And whilst they're getting on and playing, he's sat back, he's watched, he's observed. Yeah, he might make a few little changes around the edges, but he's allowed the team to develop brilliantly, and which is a fantastic masterstroke from him as a coach.
Do you know much about him?
Yes, I brought him over to England. Well, I was involved in the New South Wales exchange with Kent. So I went to New South Wales. That's how I first met Trevor Bayliss. And I spent a month with New South Wales when I was second team coach and academy coach at Kent. And Motti was the second team coach in New South Wales at the time. He tells a great story about he was brought in by New South Wales to be the assistant to Trev. And he said that Trev didn't speak to him for 3 months and he thought Trev didn't like him. And it wasn't until he realized he had to make the conversation to get Trev talking that it worked. And they had a great relationship. And then Motti came and spent a month with me with Kent's second team. That's how he first probably met Rob Key. Keyes, he was captain at the time. And so Motti and I have stayed in touch ever since. And look, he's a really, really good person. He's got very clear way of playing the game. He's done a brilliant job with the Australian women's team. And he's done a very, very good job with this England team. And it just needed a bit of time for him and Joss to find their feet and to sort of let Joss take over. And I think one of the most important things has been that Pakistan 7-match T20 series that Moeen actually captained allowed Joss to actually spend time with players. You know, there wasn't distractions of them going off and socialising. They were in the hotel together for those 7 games. It was a really good time for him and Motti to have spent a bit of time looking at what happened in the summer, really address the key personnel, and then make sure they hit the ground running for this T20 World Cup. So, look, Matthew Mott, excellent, great man. And I think the players will really, really enjoy him as a coach.
So just looking at the overview, the blueprint for success in one day cricket, which England have applied, what are the 3 key points?
Create the right environment to allow players to make mistakes. Because if you don't allow your players to make mistakes, they're not going to get better. To make sure that you've got the right players in the right places, and to make sure that and I think all players love this. Players love role clarity. They love to know what their job is. What do you want me to do? What's my job in the team? And make your players feel loved and wanted. So if you've got those 3 ingredients, you've got a great chance. And let's be honest, England have got good players. All teams have got good players. But it's about having the right environment to allow your players to develop and to make mistakes and make sure they know what their job is. And if they've got role clarity and they feel loved and wanted, and the further up the chain you go in any sport, the higher level of performance you have to put in because of the nature of the game, the more you've got to lose. So you've really got to make sure that your players feel loved and wanted. And if you get that right, you've got a great chance of success.
Well, we loved watching England play over the last 6-7 years. It's made us immensely proud. The first team to ever hold both World Cup trophies at the same time. It's absolutely fantastic. And you have played, Paul, a massive part in that. So congratulations, and congratulations to all the players as well. That is our 500th episode finished. Just another 500 to go, Simon.
Do you know when we should have tracked to 500? When we were in India, in a one-day series in India. And I'd seen up to that point, every one-day international that England had played in India in the 21st century. And in that series, England challenged India for the first time in India. Nearly every other series, they'd been thrashed from pillar to post. It was 4-1 or 5-1 or whatever, 21-0 in those 21-match series they used to have. But in that series, England challenged them. And that's when I think, you know, you thought, yeah, England are onto something here. And they do look as if they might be a side that you expect to win a world trophy rather than hope or have a sort of vague notion they might. So that was when it all started, Yoz, way back when. It's been fascinating to watch it. And it's been exciting as well. I think that's the thing. You know, for so long, English one-day cricket, English white ball cricket, has been a bit meh, really. But in the last 6 or 7 years, you actually get up in the morning and think, great, I'm going to watch a one-day international today involving England. It's actually been exciting to watch, win or lose. Anyway, there we go.
Yeah, well, England expects now in one-day cricket. It's exciting, as you say. Thanks over those 500 episodes for all your input. which has always been very well versed and articulated. So it's been fun so far, and hopefully it'll continue to be. Just a little mention of that documentary as well, The Greatest Game. It's on Sky Documentaries. It is actually a good watch, and I think in a way it encapsulates a lot of what we've been talking about today. So look out for it on Sky Documentaries. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Bye for now.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.